Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, Superman and Batman have been slugging it out and will use their recent scuffle to talk about some basic principles of blockbuster construction. Then, whether it's Batman's eponymous mobile or Thor's hammer or your own copy of The Cones of Dunshire, we'll bitterly debate the best pop culture objects. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Check out the NPR One app for your phone. Use it to listen to Pop Culture Happy Hour, and it's a great way to find tons of new shows and news from your local station. Great hand-curated podcasts and stories are always ready when you are on NPR One. Find it on your app store, NPR O-N-E.
We've got bats and Kryptonians and supervillains on the docket this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us for another round of smashing commentary, get it?
Oh, I see what you did there.
Chris Klimek, what do you do?
I'm a public defender of movies that no one wants to defend. I'm about to be disbarred.
That is not always true. So this weekend saw the release of Batman v. Superman, not versus, v.
No.
Like in any good legal case. The follow-up to 2013's Man of Steel, and similarly directed by Zack Snyder. Written by David Goyer, who also wrote Man of Steel, and Chris Terrio, who wrote the screenplay for Argo. Mm-hmm. Interesting
point of fact, I thought. You could clearly tell if you were paying attention.
Both had Ben Affleck.
Exactly. It stars Henry Cavill again as Superman and Ben Affleck for the first time as Batman, plus Amy Adams as Lois, Jesse Eisenberg as Lex Luthor, and Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman. I would remind you, as a point of reference, by the way, that we also did see and talk about Man of Steel in 2013, and we were sort of right down the middle. Chris liked it. Stephen hated it.
A lot.
I liked 60% of it, and Glenn liked somewhere in the middle.
I liked 63% of it now. Let's present our scores.
No, we're going to put out the history. You loved it. It's your favorite movie
Chris liked
of
it.
All
Chris
time.
Basically liked it.
Not, stuck up for it.
I don't know that he liked it as much as Stephen hated it, but the point, that's right. Not the point.
But I think that's a function of how universally it was pilloried.
And now
on this one, you know, to rush ahead, I'm one of the pummelers. So,
yeah, well,
someone else has to stick up for this.
So part of what happened with this week's show is we wanted to make sure that we gave the best possible opportunity that we would similarly have a range of opinions from people who dug it and didn't dig it. So we brought back Chris, who liked the first one the most out of maybe everyone I know. And Chris reviewed this film last week for NPR. I gotta say.
What did you call it? Something Zeppelin crash of a movie?
Yeah.
It was not a positive review. Talk to me about this one, Chris.
There's no one to root for in this movie. I sort of like this iteration of Batman. I mean, I'm not entirely displeased with the idea that Ben Affleck, if the studio's plans are not scuttled, will proceed and direct a Batman movie on his own. I do kind of feel like this could be a case of the Amazing Spider-Man 2, where there are, you know, all these further sequels that are, you know,
just
wiped away.
Yeah,
and in the wake of that movie's not even terrible box office, but just sort of middling. All of the inspirational qualities of superheroes in general, and these two in particular, the most iconic superheroes, the two oldest superheroes in continuous publication and cultural currency, are both kind of stamped out in this one.
Stephen, talk to me about how you reacted to this. You were the one who had the least patience for Man of Steel.
I really, really disliked Man of Steel. And all the things that I hated about it were the things that people were suddenly complaining about with this movie when I went to go see it. It's joyless. It's jokeless. It's building smashy. It's too long. It's, you know, all of these things, you know, endless, bloodless PG-13 carnage, which has become one of my least favorite things in big, loud movies.
Yeah.
All of these things are true. And when I finally saw the movie, I kind of just thought, well, where's everybody been? Like, this is, to me, it's exactly as bad as Man of Steel. It's not worse. I also hated The Dark Knight Rises, the third of the Christopher Nolan Batman movies.
You are, I think, a particularly intolerant consumer.
I'm an outlier on that one. That's one I like less than.
And I do love those. Like, I am a big booster of the whole Nolan.
I like the first two Nolan Batmans fine. I just found the third one, I don't know if it was the mood I was in that day.
It was just not
what I wanted. So to me, I didn't feel like this was necessarily worse. I went in with expectations incredibly low. Everybody was pounding this thing. You know, by the time I saw it, it had gotten, you know, a Rotten Tomatoes score of 30 and all that. And I kind of was like, this is exactly what I expected it to be. This isn't really worse.
Yeah. How about you, Glenn?
You know the story of the scorpion and the frog? The frog takes it upon the scorpion, stings it. And why'd you do that? It's just my nature. They have handed this franchise to the scorpion. And they can't be surprised when he makes this film.
Right.
This is the film he was always going to make. I am grateful to this film, though, for giving me the key to understanding the moral universe that Zack Snyder is peopling his films in. This is the moral universe where the following is true. We find this out about midway through the film. Not going to say how we find that out, but we find out that if you want to save a farm, you got to drown some horses. That is the lesson that he wants us to take away from this. Now, you can say that that's realistic, or you can say that's fatalistic. I find it fatalistic.
Yeah.
On Twitter yesterday, I got pushback. Oh, no, that's just realistic. You know, that's just the way the world works. When we depose a despot, we get ISIS. You know, that's just the way. And let's just stipulate that when your film is about a flying spaceman versus a billionaire ninja detective, to employ the word realistic is asking it to just do a lot of heavy lifting, just so much heavy lifting. So, look, there's a lot of different versions of these characters out there. One could write a book about how many different versions there are.
Indeed.
And that's a net good thing. Now, this version of these two characters is going to become the one that dominates popular culture for a period of years, just because that's the power of movies like this. They change the narrative. They change the conversation. But that doesn't mean that other versions go away. And fandom is better. Genre is better. Stories are better. Film is better when they are less monolithic, when a lot of different versions, a lot of different approaches, capital D diversity, lowercase d diversity, when that happens. Right before I saw this film, there was a trailer for the Lego Batman movie.
Yeah.
Where Batman is positioned as a self-important, self-satisfied tool, basically. Mm-hmm. And I feel a resonance with that version of Batman. I kind of get that version
of Batman. I remember how much we liked that version of Batman in the Lego movie.
So I don't go to a film, and again, more power to you if this is your Batman.
Right.
If this
I
is
agree.
Your Superman. More
I
power
agree.
To you, but I don't go to a film about a flying spaceman and a billionaire ninja detective looking for a bleak, monotonous, depressing, pseudo-philosophical meditation on the futility of virtue, right? The futility of good intentions.
Yeah.
The futility of selflessness. The futility of, forget about being a hero, just trying to do the right thing. In this moral universe, you are doomed to try to be that way. And that's just the way the world works. That's just realism. That was my issue with it.
What's interesting for me about this movie is, I don't think this is any sort of spoiler, particularly by the time this show comes out, but the setup for this film is the end of Man of Steel, which, as we talked about at the time, is a climax with a tremendously high body count and a lot of sort of wanton destruction that is positioned as a sort of victory, kind of.
Only destroyed part of the Earth. Yeah.
And I think
if they didn't pause for a kiss on top of the rubble, it would not have gone down nearly as badly as it did. But that's a horribly tone-deaf moment.
And the thing that I find fascinating, it's not just aftermath, but they actually pick this movie up simultaneously with the ending sequence in Man of Steel. You are seeing it from now Bruce Wayne's perspective as he rushes to Metropolis from Gotham, which is across the river.
I hate that so much.
Well, as I have heard from Glenn, is actually an old piece of information in some versions.
Right. But that's two DC reboots ago, right?
Yeah, at least.
It doesn't matter.
I think it's wrong. Fish to fry here.
So you have Bruce Wayne rushing to Metropolis where he sees all of this destruction and one of his buildings is destroyed and people that he knows are killed. And to me, that's a very good idea for a Batman versus Superman movie. My initial reaction was, this is a very good idea for how to set this up. Mm-hmm. Because, and Glenn and I were talking about this earlier today, there's a way to see these characters where Superman is much more the big picture guy and is more like a country, like a like a world government, and Batman is more like a cop. And it makes sense mm-hmm. to me that their interplay might be complicated based on, you know, you see ultimate absolute power as a good thing. I see ultimate absolute power as something that no one should hold, right? This is an interesting tension, particularly mm-hmm. at this moment in all of our lives. And I was totally on board for the underlying idea of this movie, which it then pretty much totally abandons.
Right.
That is not what most of this movie is about. You go almost immediately to the fake place Nairobi, Africa, which is basically like creating a town called Hayseed, the South, where the only thing you're trying to do is bring in people's kind of preconceived notions of this kind of place. You're not trying to create a specific place. I did not like that. I understand it's unfashionable to say, I didn't understand what the heck was going on.
No,
half
but that plot point was super confusing.
There is a lot of, I don't think I'm a dumb person, and I felt like literally figuring out who was doing what for what reason was more difficult than it seemed like it should be.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't typically have trouble following action movies or comic book movies or even like complex
movies
with
V in the title.
No,
generally
I don't. That's typically not my reaction. My disappointment was this movie has to me several good ideas in it.
Yeah.
It has that idea in it. There is a conversation between Lois and Clark Kent in which she talks about, is it possible for you to be you and also love me? That's a good idea that has been explored in other versions of this story. I even like the idea that Eisenberg's Lex Luthor is kind of just an amped up Zuckerberg.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same performance, but like 20% more crazy.
Yeah. Did you understand what he wanted to do?
I understood he wanted to burn everything down and make them fight.
Yeah.
I didn't necessarily understand.
His role was to
I didn't
get them
necessarily
to fight,
understand the specifics of of his plot.
Well,
so the way I come to this movie was, look, we talked about this with the first one, too. Chris hates it when we say movies are too long. This movie is not too long because it's too long for any movie, but it's too long for this movie in that the entire last act feels totally extraneous and tacked on to me. It builds to what feels like a natural climax, and then it has an additional half an hour.
But wait, there's still more.
Yeah. But wait, there's still more.
I think it's paced poorly,
and
it's actually kind of trying to do too much for this amount of running time. There are too many movies here. None of them are sufficiently developed.
Right.
So it's just a lot of stuff that we've, you know, it's still coming long after we've lost our investment in it.
So I am not in the position of being like, this movie is all irredeemable garbage and all that stuff. I am in the position of saying, I kind of want to see the movie I thought they were going to make.
Mm-hmm.
I don't inherently have a problem with the darkness of it, and I don't think any of us do, given the fact that I think we're all appreciators of some of the stuff that Nolan did. It's not the darkness of it. I didn't think they developed the ideas. I want to point out that one of the things that Glenn talked about on Twitter was that Batman, in fact, would do CrossFit by himself.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I do think the Batman training montage is one of several things that's unintentionally funny.
Yeah, because, I mean, yeah, he would do CrossFit. He would do the obsessed thing, but he'd do it at home by himself.
Yeah,
that's exactly it.
And I talked to our pal, Gene Demby, today, who's a CrossFit guy, and verified that hammering on a tire is a real cross.
It's a real thing.
Yeah. No, that's
which I looked at it and I was like, why is he hammering a tire?
Yeah.
Oh, that's on HBO 24/7 all the time.
Yeah.
Chris, you know more about this than I do. So what we thought would be less interesting would be just talking about not liking this movie for the entirety of the segment. So we wanted to kind of broaden out a little bit and talk about what is it that you want from a movie, not necessarily like this, but from kind of a big, loud movie. How do you distinguish the good ones from the bad ones? Do you have an answer to this, Glenn?
Well, it's not what I'm looking for, but it's what I always see, which is third act problems.
Yeah.
Blockbusters come pre-equipped, factory installed with third act problems. The very first, there's an exception here, the very first blockbuster, everybody, what was it?
Jaws.
Now, that film builds.
Mm-hmm.
Builds steadily, and that final act does not disappoint. It also contains a thing that is usually a sign that something has gone horribly wrong, a big explosion.
Yeah.
Big, dumb explosions mean third act problems often. Again, in Jaws, exception to the rule, because that big, dumb explosion was earned and kind of cool. But Hollywood seems to believe that we are fascinated by just ordnance, just, you know, big fire. And the ones that kind of escape that historically, Jurassic Park is about escaping. So it seems linear. So the third act is, it follows logically because it's the end of the story. They have to get off the island. Guardians of the Galaxy, I didn't mind that third act, even though there is a big, huge, stupid thing that, you know, something's going to come out of the sky.
Yeah. Right.
Didn't mind it because, again, it was tongue-in-cheek. We kind of all knew when we had Glenn Close with bad hair.
Careful kind to of, point out that they've evacuated and they try to lower the body count for that compared to what it could be.
Some of the other first blockbusters, Close Encounters. Again, that has a kind of weirdly cerebral third act where it's very quiet and it's about contact. And it couldn't happen today because, again, we'd need a big stupid explosion. So,
well, you've done three Spielbergs
just in
the five that you've named. So that might be a...
That's because when I think of blockbusters, I think of him. Like, Ghostbusters, something big explodes at the end, but again, the work has been done to set up the final joke of who will become your destroyer.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing I really brought to this. I mean, I don't need big dumb explosions. I don't need third act problems. I always get them.
Yeah. How about you, Chris?
You know, I always think of an example of one that does have kind of a smaller, quieter, faster, but still more satisfying climax is Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was a Christmas release, I think, and obviously not a film of U.S. provenance. You know, this is a movie that has spectacular stunts and action scenes and stuff kind of woven throughout, but it doesn't put the biggest one at the end. And the fact that it's, you know, it resolves so quickly, the action scene at the end is so terse, makes it more powerful in a way. Like, it doesn't wear you out.
Yeah. How about you, Stephen? What do you think?
You know, it's funny. One of the questions that you posed when we were originally talking about this topic is, do these movies need to have jokes? We've talked a lot about how portentous and dour and dire a lot of, like, the DC comic stuff is in particular. And then we talk about that in relation to movies like Guardians of the Galaxy or Avengers, the Marvel stuff, Ant-Man, that have a springiness to them, a vibrancy.
And even those are on a sliding scale.
Oh, absolutely.
Like, Ant-Man is way sillier than
Captain America, for example. But I immediately thought, well, of course, I am somebody, I just want jokes. You need to puncture the self-seriousness of it. And I started thinking about movies like Mad Max Fury Road, which is not a funny movie, but has...
No,
it's very, very dour. But its levity comes in the form of this incredible visual invention.
I was just going to say, it's story dour, but it's visually incredibly exciting.
It doesn't have quips, but I do think there are a lot of funny moments.
But there's visual playfulness in that movie. You have the stuff with the masked guitarist and the guitar
him being strapped as a blood bag to the front of the car like a hood ornament.
Yeah,
he's complaining about it as they're driving.
Like, that just visual invention. That sense of creative minds at play, I think, is so important to set any given movie apart from the beats of these endless, very, very, very similar movies.
Yeah.
You know, I saw a trailer for the new Star Trek movie, and it just immediately thought back of, oh, man, oh, yeah, okay, this last Star Trek movie, that was where the big ship crashes into the big building.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they just run together in my mind unless you have ways to make them pop just in my own memory as different from other movies like them.
Yeah. So I'm going to go back to something that I think Chris and I have probably recommended on this show 8 or 10 times. I can never talk about it enough, which is the director's commentary and all of the commentary material on Die Hard. And the reason why I go back to it and back to it and back to it is there's a tremendous amount of conversation about the careful structuring of what is fundamentally a popcorn movie and how intricately done it is. And if you've seen the movie, you know this, right? Everything in that movie is there for a reason. Every, you know, he takes his shoes off because later you're going to get a payoff. There's, you know, she puts the picture down, later you're going to get a payoff. Everything in there is really carefully put together. So for me, one of the things in blockbuster movies or popcorn movies or fun movies or big movies, I still want them to make that internal sense that makes me feel like they're still being carefully told.
Yeah.
And of all the things, I mean, I'm good at putting aside the unreal nature of something like Mad Max Fury Road or whatever. I'm not as good at putting aside the individual scene-by-scene pieces of what people are doing doesn't make any sense to me. That I tend to get frustrated by. I would also point to the fact that if you're going to say, I'm just at this movie for fun. I'm just at this movie for the sheer visceral thrill of it. Make a Fast and Furious movie. It is not as well known as my love of Die Hard, but I kind of love the Fast and Furious movies.
Sure.
And it's because, in fact, Chris and I went to, I think,
yes,
7, and I liked it way better than
you
Chris did.
Well, we went to 6 and 7.
That's true, we did. We went to 6 and 7. And I liked them probably more than Chris did, particularly 7.
You did. But I mean, there's an explanation for that too. I mean, in the same way that Glenn is sort of, you know, mocking and exhausted of people who overtax the Batman idea. He thinks that Nolan is trying to bring gravitas to something that is fundamentally light and silly and for children, but clearly works for a lot of people. Those movies were the most successful films that have been made of Batman.
I would say if you're gonna do a serious Nolan-esque approach, that the meeting of character and director really work there.
I think
where I get upset is when that tone is used for Superman, is used for everybody.
Well, this is what I'm saying. Linda talked about how Die Hard has all of these elements that are, you know, rigorously set up and then paid off. And I think all of Nolan's movies are like that, to the point that some people find it a little airless. Designed. There's no emotional messiness to them.
Yeah.
And I hear that, but it mostly works for me. The reason that the Fast and the Furious movies bug me is because they are so over the top silly.
Yeah.
And you know, they expect their audience.
I do not deny it.
Yeah, but I mean, and they you know, clearly that's the intent, and they know the audience will receive them that way. And I kind of feel like that's mocking, you know, John McTiernan and people who bring a more rigorous approach to those kinds of movies.
I feel like a movie like Fast and the Furious, that's like, those are to movies what Andrew WK is to Hard Rock. Like, taking it so over the top that it's every second is sillier than the second before. I'm here for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the things that's come out of this debate about Batman v Superman that I do think is helpful and interesting is fans of movies wanting to assert, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, critic who didn't like this movie, maybe it's just not your thing. To which I say, correct. that's okay. And it's... that, to me, is a healthy way to exist in the universe. Mm-hmm. You're probably right. As Glenn said before, if it's your thing, that's great. This is not the kind of movie where I'm bothered if people like it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Despite the fact that it has some stuff I don't like. There's kind of a throng of African guys at the beginning and a throng of Asian women at one point and a throng of Mexican people. That's the kind of stuff where I'm uneasy about it. But this is not the kind of movie where I think, if you like this movie, that really bugs me.
Right.
Like, this is the kind of movie where this is not my thing, particularly not at a 2.5-hour running time. If it was at a 1.5-hour running time, you know, maybe so.
Yeah, and you see all this stuff about, oh, it did really well on Friday, but boy, it took a steep drop off from Friday to Saturday and Saturday to Sunday, and that proves that actually the critics were right and you fanboys are wrong. I just find that so boring and pointless.
It's so unnecessary. It is a movie.
You're allowed to like it if you like it.
Well, and honestly, if you look at this movie and think it might be your thing, then it might be your thing.
Yeah.
Like, which is more power to you.
And have a great time, man.
Like what you like.
Muzzle tough.
I recommend a recliner theater. It is a long movie. All right. When we come back, we are going to talk about pop culture objects. I'm kind of interested in where this is going to go. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour comes from the Lagunitas Brewing Company. Popular belief has it that Lagunitas began on a kitchen stove in Northern California in 1993. From actually getting beers into bottles and onto the streets, Lagunitas looks to the future. From expanding the Petaluma Brewery to building a second in Chicago and soon a third in Azusa, California, to bringing its flagship IPA across the pond, Lagunitas could probably make good beer on the moon if needed. Because wherever you go, beer speaks, people mumble. More mumblings at Lagunitas.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about superheroes and a big superhero movie. Now we're going to switch gears and we're going to do a quick turn around the table. We're going to talk about pop culture objects. Now, the way that I phrased this question to our lovely panelists, and this one sprang just from my crazy brain, was name the pop culture object that you would most like to possess. So we're going to go around, see what people have to say. It can be any object from pop culture. No picking people, anything like that. Stephen Thompson.
Everything I thought about was a place signifying some sort of fantasia of my youthful imagination.
I thought you were going to say everything I thought of was from The Simpsons.
No, the examples that really stuck hardest with me are both from my youth. What they have in common is that they're both places that are occupied by adults who behave like children.
Oh.
And who create for themselves a world like a child might.
I know
hope.
What one of them is.
So one of them is Tom Hanks's apartment in the movie Big. Which is full of arcade machines, and you can see where I'm going with
that. I don't know if it qualifies as an object, but I'll go with you.
The other one is a little more object-based, Pee-wee Herman's kitchen.
Sure.
Oh, kitchen.
In Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Uh-huh. The I have a little bit of a reaction every time I go into a place that is full of kind of crazy crap on the walls, as Mo, speaking of The Simpsons, would say. I was recently at a comedy club in Austin called Esther's Follies, which is full of just detritus, and I walked in and there's like an old TV set that's been turned into a fish tank. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, this is my kind of place. I just love rooms full of childlike wonder. So for me, like Pee-wee Herman's bicycle,
sure.
Just anything that is like a totem of youth and innocence as enjoyed by adults.
Very wonderful. What a good pick. Mm. Again, I'm not sure a place counts.
A kitchen is a thing.
I don't know, as Kitchen's an object.
A room. Yeah.
I don't know if that's an object, but I'm going to go with you.
Rube Goldberg device that makes his breakfast.
There you go.
That's what I want.
There you go.
That's very specific.
That's very specific. That's closer. Closer to the assignment, young Stephen. Thank you very much, buddy. Glenn Weldon.
I had a lot of problem with this because here's the thing. If you get the object, your life doesn't change. You don't become the person who owns that object
sure.
in your life. You become a dude who has that thing.
Yeah, I know.
And then you have to kind of fit it into your life, and it never fits into your
this
life.
This is why my answer's so good. Wait till you hear it.
Because, I mean, like, I wanted Excalibur from the movie Excalibur, but then I'd just be a dude with a sword walking around.
Yeah, right.
I wanted a lightsaber, but then I'd be, like, a lightsaber guy. I don't have a lightsaber
guy. You can
guy,
have that.
Like, in suburban Philadelphia.
Yeah, sell that. That's available.
I know. I wanted Glamdring the Foe Hammer from Lord of the Rings. Couldn't get that. I wanted the Necronomicon from Evil Dead 2, the Book of the Dead. That would have been a lot of fun. And I had some experience with this. Like, I loved the crossbow that Carol Bouquet used in For Your Eyes Only, such that I begged my parents to get me a crossbow. And then they did. And that Christmas morning, I went out to the backyard, propped up a mattress, aimed a single bolt into the mattress to kind of do some target practice. And it went through the mattress way into the forest. And I was like, I'm done. Nope. Not, this is way too dangerous.
You got a crossbow.
I will kill myself or others. So I put it
away. Holy moly.
Similarly, my grandmother in fourth grade knitted me a Doctor Who scarf, one of these 12-foot long Doctor Who scarves. There's not a big cosplay circuit when you're 4 years old in fourth grade. I just didn't have any.
Sounds like a choking hazard. 12
yes,
feet
exactly.
of scarf.
Yeah,
like sure. How many scarves is
that? I wanted, the teenage me who was going into Philadelphia to South Street and watching Repo Man every Friday night, trying desperately to be punk and failing miserably. I wanted the 64 Chevelle Malibu with the glowing trunk from that movie. I wanted the 66 Batmobile, of course. But again, I'm not a strong driver, so it wouldn't work. It wouldn't work.
Hey, once you're behind the wheel of it, you're a strong guy.
No, because then everybody's looking at you. I wouldn't want to be that guy. The Batphone, okay? So the Batphone lights up red from the 66 series, comes underneath the cake lid. I love that whole thing.
Yeah.
But then I thought to myself, I hate talking on the phone.
Yeah.
every time it would beep, I'd be like, get some anxiety. So I've decided.
What if you want to call someone who's not Commissioner Gordon?
See, that's the thing.
How does that work?
Shakespeare bust. The Shakespeare bust where you pull back the head, you turn on the dial. I would love a bookcase that slides open. I'd love a bat cave, but that's a place. Again, Stephen.
All right. I posit that places are things.
So I would go with a Shakespeare bust.
Shakespeare bust.
From the 66 Batman series.
From the 66 Batman series. Mm-hmm. I love that. That's a great answer. Thank you, buddy. Chris Klimek.
Well, I thought about going with Batman 66's utility belt, but I figured you'd be all over that.
Yeah.
And also, since I am here to stick up for the more grounded Nolan Batman, where he can, presumably only carry like 3 or 4 things on his belt.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I had to go to the most iconic movie hero who has come to be defined by his accessories.
Right.
Jess, clip 3, please.
Q Branch has put together a smart-looking piece of luggage for us. We're issuing this to all 00 personnel.
Now, normally, to open a case like that, you move the catches to the side. If you do, the cartridge will explode in your face. Now, to stop the cartridge exploding, turn the catches horizontally, like that. Then, open normally. Now, you try it.
Turn the catches like that.
That's right.
And open ordinarily.
You got it?
Yes, I think so.
Now imagine you're 8 years old in 1964 watching two old men open a briefcase together over the course of like a full minute, like 1% of the running time of From Russia with Love, which is my favorite Bond movie. This is the first of the Bond gadgets. It's not very outlandish. It's a briefcase. It's got bullets in it. It also has a knife, 20 gold sovereigns, valid all countries, a sniper rifle. And that's it. And, well, of course, the booby trap, where if you open it incorrectly, the tear gas cartridge explodes. I like my privacy. The reason I chose this, though, is because this has, like, sort of becomes kind of a blockbuster trope. This is the planted payoff, because this is Chekhov's exploding suitcase.
Yeah.
You know, we're taking all this time to slow the already kind of talky movie to explain what all this stuff does.
Right.
It's going to come back. And this becomes a fundamental piece of the blockbuster later.
And so it would be special to you to possess it.
Yes, to have a briefcase.
Nice.
One of these days.
One of these days.
Maybe I'll put a knife in it. But that,
Thank you, Chris Klimek. All right. So I chose mine with the way Glenn talked about. You want to think about your life with the thing in it. You want to think, what would it be like not to be the person who had the thing, but to be me and have the thing? Mm-hmm. And that is why I picked Kit from Knight Rider.
I see.
Because I am a girl with a long commute. And I was trying to think, what would be a fun way to stand out on my long commute from all of the other, you know, workaday humans?
All the light blue Priuses and beige minivans.
All the Priuses and minivans driving into the city of Washington from my hinterlands in Maryland. Mm-hmm. How do I stand out? Kit. Now.
Mission accomplished.
I'm driving Kit into work. Vroom,
sometimes
vroom.
Kit may be driving you.
Exactly. So I'm driving Kit. And I want you to picture me pulling into the garage at NPR in Kit. Because there's a guy there who's by the security gate, who you put your little card in,
nice guy.
Drive in the security gate. So I'm driving by the guy at the security gate, and he's looking at me, and I'm in Kit. Mm-hmm. And then I'm driving down through the little thing, and I'm parking in the garage, and I'm pulling by all the Priuses and all the, I don't want to blow your mind, but there are actually some Priuses in our garage on a given day.
You don't say.
Drive down there, park in my little spot, get out, and it's Kit. And all day long, there are people walking around going, who put Kit in the parking garage? And I'm saying, I'm the one who put Kit in the parking garage.
That's me.
Kit in the parking garage. So that is my object, Kit, strictly for the fun of pulling into the parking garage and being the person who parks Kit in our garage.
Well, Kit has that little red, like, flashy beacon thing, so you can always find it easily.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I would just say, Kit, where are you? And Kit would speak to me and flash the little lights.
You'd have to change his, so he would... You'd have to reprogram so it didn't go, Michael. He would have to say, Linda.
That's right. I would reprogram Kit.
My guess is that the technology used to create Kit could be modified to say Linda.
Agreed. So that is my pop culture object. I would love to hear about some of your favorite pop culture objects. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org, or you can tweet at us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what is making us happy this week. So come right back.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by Weebly. You don't have to be a web designer or know code to create a fantastic website with Weebly. Created for people with the courage to start their own business and the dream to be their own boss. Choose from professionally designed mobile-friendly themes. Then just drag and drop to quickly build and publish your site and update your site on any device. Get started for free at weebly.com/happyhour. weebly.com/happyhour.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Between now and when this episode drops on Empire, from what I gather, they are shouting out Tiny Desk Concerts.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure how. I'm not sure why, but we know
it's all happening.
We all know that it's happening, and we're like, I've been looking, poking around. Linda, do you have a press screener so we can see what they say about Tiny Desk Concerts? I'm going to assume that it's good, and that if you haven't seen it yet, be sure, you know, maybe you're a time shifter or whatever, check out this week's Empire. We are very, very proud of that. The other thing that I brought, this is a minor pleasure. This is a very minor pleasure. I got this from Linda Holmes. I actually had to ask you to make sure that you were not bringing it as what is.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
I owe a degree of thanks to our pal Alex Kappelman.
That's right.
Who,
friend of the show,
apparently sends this link to you, Linda, on a regular basis. Over the weekend, I had to replace a window pane in my house, and when it was over, I played myself this clip.
You smart. You very smart. We the best. You a genius. I appreciate you. You loyal. I changed a lot. You can too. Win, 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 no matter what.
I just want to play the whole thing. I don't want to stop it. That is DJ Khaled, who, as part of his like series of inspirational videos.
Yeah.
When we talked about DJ Khaled, it was in the context of his Snapchats promoting Chirac Apple.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when Alex was talking about them, I'm like, those sound funny. They sound delightful. This absolutely 100% unironically completely delights me.
Yes, that's great.
I watched this video of DJ Khaled complimenting me and appreciating me over and over and over again.
Yeah.
It culminates in him coaching you through your like sit-ups and push-ups regimen.
Another one, another one, another one, and another one.
The next time I have to do something plodding, like watch Batman versus Superman, for example, I'm just
going to... You want someone sitting behind you going, continue to sit.
Don't get up.
Stay there.
Don't get up.
So DJ Khaled, who is very quickly becoming my life coach, is making me very, very happy this week.
I endorse that.
It will enrich your life. Yeah. Spend the minute and a half it takes to watch this.
As much as you like it now, imagine if it was texted to you unexpectedly or gifts from it were texted to you unexpectedly. Anyway, thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. I endorse both of your picks. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, sir?
My book came out, and the ebook came out, and the audiobook came out. And, you know, I've been hearing from people who were liking it, and that's great. And there was a great reading presentation sort of launch thing at Word Bookstore in Brooklyn. They were very cool.
Mm-hmm.
And Alex Chi was there with me to kind of share that evening. It was awesome. And I did a radio tour, several radio tours, actually, and I talked to a lot of NPR stations, sober-minded people who had actually read the book.
And
isn't that the best?
Wanted to know about Batman, a strong fellow who fights crime nocturnally. But I also did, and it was they were awesome, but I also did, unexpectedly, I did a radio tour of morning shows. So I also talked to a lot of alternate variations of Crazy Ira and the Douche. And that was not a thing that I ever anticipated would happen to me. And yet it did, and that was perfectly fine. It was perfectly wonderful, but that was weird. But the thing that's making me happy this week is completely different. It is Pee-wee's Big Holiday on Netflix. This is a sequel, a long-awaited sequel to... It's a sequel to Big Adventure. We pretend that Big Top Pee-wee didn't happen for a variety of reasons.
Right.
Does it live up to Big Adventure? No, it does not. But what are you doing? Like, what? Like, you know what you're getting in for, right? You know what this is? It's exactly that. Any time Joe Manganiello is on the screen and they are having some chemistry, some weird... twisted, weird chemistry between them. It is just a delight. So that is Pee-wee's Big Holiday on Netflix right now.
It's better than Big Top Pee-wee is what you're saying.
It is better than Big Top Pee-wee. It scratches the itch, Pee-wee Herman-shaped itch that many of us have carried with us.
And you're
like eczema into adulthood.
And you're here for Pee-wee.
I'm here for Pee-wee.
You loyal.
Okay. All right. So that's what that was. I was wondering what that was, and now I realize what that was.
Chris Klimek. Thank you, Glenn. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Two music videos are making me happy now.
Music videos?
Partially, yes. Under the influence of a certain podcast and Glenn here, I've recently become aware of Rachel Bloom. She released a new song, I think today, that elucidates a problem that I have heard from the distaff attendees of many of my fitness classes.
It's true.
Which are most of the attendees of my fitness classes.
It's true.
The song pauses in the moment for a brief astronomy lesson, which is quite a feat given that it runs only a hair over 2 minutes. I'm sure people who are interested can find it. It's called Heavy Boobs.
It is called Heavy Boobs. Very funny.
Yes. Can we play the clip of the other music video? I think this was number 4. So as I age, I fear a creeping conservatism in my musical taste, so that when someone sends me a video of the United States Navy Band performing Thriller at the U.S. Navy Memorial, just a mile and a half from where we now sit,
nice.
You know, it reassures me that I am open to bold new things. I suggest you go find the video of this. This is the Sea Chanters, Cruisers, and Concert Band, by the way, featuring musician first class Maya M. Rodriguez and arranged by senior chief musician Scott Silbert. These are real naval ranks. The video is kind of fun because you see them sort of awkwardly kind of shimmying in their dress white uniforms, and that's funny for about a minute. And then we get to the zombie break where they actually get up and do a very respectable zombie dance. And it's the kind of thing where you've kind of gotten used to the idea that these are dorks and this is embarrassing and they shouldn't be doing this. And this is like David Lee Roth fronting the Boston Pops on the 4th of July. And then the dance is great. Like, they really kill the dance. So it's funny two times. Wow. The fact that they are doing this right where the National Archives is, there's a scene in World War Z of the Army carrying the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution out of the National Archives because of the impending zombie plague.
Sure.
And then seeing all these naval officers in dress uniforms do the zombie dance right there has a weird resonance. Maybe it speaks only to me. But the video is there for those who wish to find it. It is the United States Navy Band performing Thriller.
Chris Klimek, I appreciate you.
Okay.
So before I talk about what's making me happy, we have a little bit of fun news. Starting next week, we have a special offer for those of you who want to try something a little bit new. You have heard us do promos on this show for NPR One, which is an app that will give you NPR content and content from your local station and podcasts, both our podcasts and other people's podcasts. During the month of April, if you want to give NPR One a try, you will find the show on there on Thursday morning. A day early. If you do not want to do that, change nothing. Nothing will change for you. You will get the show on Friday, just as you always have. But if you are interested in giving NPR One a try, you will find the show on there on Thursday mornings. And to find that, you can find it at your app store, whether it's at Apple or Android or Windows or whatever, wherever you get your apps. There is a web version of it if you want to find that, if you are not a smartphone person. NPR One is a kind of like my explanation of it and their explanation of it is always a sort of Pandora for public radio. You get different stories and different stuff kind of all mashed up. I do listen to it myself.
Yes.
And so that will be a special treat for those of you who want to give it a try during the month of April. The other thing making me happy this week, it has been a while since we talked about an episode of 99% Invisible. There was a recent episode in which they talked about food styling. And there have been a lot of photo essays and other things where they show this is how they make food, this is how they put food, and make it look shiny and fancy, and look, this isn't really grease, it's really whatever. This is a little different. It's the story of the guy who came up with the idea of kind of food being in motion when you make like TV commercials. Yeah. The little tease that they did was about why are the shrimp always flying through the air in the shrimp commercials. And it's related to, as somebody immediately pointed out on Twitter, it's related to why the Coke in the glass is always sloshing. It's one of those things that they do on that show that sounds like it's not a story, but it is really fun. And also, do not listen to it when you are hungry, because even listening to this story of how they make food look appealing made me hungry because I listened to it before breakfast while I was commuting, tragically not in kit. So that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen and Glenn at GH Weldon. You can follow Chris at CT Klimek, K-L-I-M-E-K. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy, and our producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are bobbing your head to right now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Check out NPR's Bullseye with Jesse Thorne, an excellent guide to what's good in pop culture. Every week, Jesse Thorne interviews people like Elvis Costello, Zach Galifianakis, and Spike Lee about their creative work and lives. Find your new favorite TV shows, books, movies, and music, and gain new insights into the things you already love. Find Bullseye now at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.